This is Audible.
Da 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 da! Penguin Random House Audio presents Wildflower. This is the author, Drew Barrymore. To my friend family, my flower family, my Copelman family, and my daughters, thank you. You taught me everything I know. Preface. I wrote this book without assuming anyone would ever read it. And yet, I wrote it for you, the person listening to this right now. If it feels personal for you, then I am so happy, because it was personal for me. I didn't write it in any particular format. This is not a sweeping life story, but an elaboration on times in my life as I remembered them. I asked myself from time to time over the course of exactly 1 year, what should I revisit? Or what stories should I tell? Because to me, these are stories. My publisher wanted to call this a memoir at first, but that didn't sound right. Memoir seemed heavy to me, and I wanted this to be light. This is a book you can dip into or listen to whenever you want. A book you can read when you want. A book you can listen to when you want. But I can only hope that every once in a while it catches you inconveniently feeling something. It was inconvenient writing it with two young daughters. They are my universe, and I felt terrible pulling myself away from them to write. Ever. But every mother knows how this feels. However, I discovered that over this year, that being a mother is at times hardest in the transitions. Pulling yourself away, you feel like the devil. But once you do, you can be more present. And the gift is that once you pull yourself away from your responsibilities, you can fully be a parent. It's being present that matters most. And when I was writing, I shut my door. I would let the inspiration flow. For some reason, I had to write this book. I have become more private every year, and yet these stories were beating at the door of my heart, screaming, "Let me out!" Maybe it was that I have always dreamed of being a writer. Those people who do the typing and the transporting are my heroes. I have never been able to do that. I've never been brave enough, smart enough, had enough to say. I had not exercised those abilities in my life. And now I have, alone in a room. And yet, as I say in the book, you do nothing in this life alone. And most of all, you do not live alone. And therefore, we all have stories to tell. These are mine. Wildflower, a poem. Out there in the world of chaos, all the concrete and fumes, people with determination behind the wheel, the soles of their feet wiser, some faces with souls of routine, others with high hope of their destination, among all the human and industrial invention, my eyes find a tiny wildflower. With pretty yellow petals and a brown button nose, reminding me that there is beauty everywhere. A compass of nature, a second of stillness in my mind, as my heart races to the rhythms of its swaying in the wind. You are that flower, reminding me of what is real. Birds of Paradise. In 1975, the neighborhood I grew up in, West Hollywood, was a colorful place. It had an aesthetic of old cars, the way one idealizes Havana, and the wildly different styles of architecture from one house or apartment building to another. Santa Monica Boulevard with its pimps and old movie theaters. and the drag queens. That was just a fact that the kids from our hood grew up with. Mom, is it a man or a woman? And then the parents could probably individually decide how to answer. But having this colorful world all around is what made this area so interesting. My mother, then named Ildiko Jade, raised me as a single mother there. She was an aspiring actress who did bit parts here and there and worked two jobs at the infamous Comedy Store and also at the notorious music venue, the Troubadour. She was living a life around many wild artists, and the whole scene of that era was very hedonistic. She was also friends with many gay men, so that just became a part of life too. Their style and their wit were comforting. We lived on Poinsettia Place in a tiny duplex that had a giant wall of bougainvillea up the front, about 25 feet high, which to a little kid seemed like a skyscraper, and it made our place stand out on the street. This dramatic, hardy flower with its deep maroon made me so happy. I was so in love with its color, and it taught me that beauty could live in any city area. Not only live, but be strong. We lived on one side of the duplex, and our neighbor on the other side was Joni Goodfellow. Her son was Daniel Faircloth, and it was only after years later that it struck me how distinct their names were. At the time, she was just another single mom, much like mine, whose man had taken off, leaving just her and the kid. I still can't remember the name of the father, but I remember he was from somewhere like Delaware or Denver, neither place I knew or geography in general, but every time she talked about him, I would picture him in a Western shirt or cowboy boots. Don't ask me why. Men left and moms worked were the messages I was receiving from our lives in this duplex. I still have no clue what Joni did. Joni was eccentric. She had electric blue hair or neon green and would slink around the apartment like an exhibitionist with very little clothing, often having two cockatoos perched one on each shoulder. At first, I was wide-eyed about it, but eventually I would have been more shocked to find it any different. Strange what we get used to. Her son Daniel became my best friend, even though I didn't even know what that was at the time. But we would sell apples up and down the street and beat the shit out of each other. A typical West Hollywood friendship, I think. When it was time for him to go to bed, every night was the same routine. Joni would say, "Okay, time for bed," and he would immediately start climbing the curtains in their living room. It was as if he was in a gym making his way up the rope. He would scream, When he had almost reached the top, Joni would just pluck him off and throw him in the bedroom down the hall. Our duplexes each had two bedrooms. It seemed spacious to me. I was actually proud that these single moms could provide a two-bedroom situation for us kids. To have all our own rooms was nothing to scoff at. There was also a teeny tiny backyard with a cheap swing set and an avocado tree. To say that I ate 10 avocados a day off that tree was no exaggeration. I loved that tree. It nourished me, and other than the cascading bougainvillea out front, it was my only source of nature. Just like me, the tree and the flower bush didn't mind that they were existing amongst crime and X-rated movie theaters. We were all just really happy in our fantasy land. In fact, the significance of the avocado tree is still as strong as can be for me. I even have it in my will that I want to be buried under one, or have some of my ashes put there. Some avocado tree, preferably on a hill that is nowhere near anything this time. Just up a hill on a rolling mountain, preferably with an ocean view. I can dream. For now, my nature consisted of the things living and growing at Poinsettia Place. And most jarring to me was the strange-looking plant on the side of the house. There was a narrow, long driveway that led from front to back, all concrete. It was where my mom would park her beat-up, discolored, temperamental old Volkswagen Karmann Ghia. But alongside the driveway, lining the house, were plants called birds of paradise. They have a long, pale green stalk with bright orange pointy petals and some blue accents. Picture the colors that the gas stove burner emits. Blues and oranges. They are spiky and they look like they belong in Palm Springs or the Galapagos, not hidden in West Hollywood. I would stare at these things, wondering if they were plants or flowers. They look like angry flamingos. They scared me. I would look for the eyes, but I was always afraid they would come to life and bite me. I stayed away, but then would tiptoe around them every once in a while with sick fascination. In a life where, as a kid, I had many questions about what was this or what was that, this vegetation was the embodiment of everything in the neighborhood. It couldn't be defined. Joni and Daniel moved out when I was around 4 or 5. I was so sad. But then this really nice couple with a Dalmatian named McBarker moved in. Gina and Joel were a cute, attractive, lovely couple, and I took right to them. Especially Joel, as I was starved for anything straightforward like an unconfusing male. There was no, are you gay, straight, a man, or a woman? I know you're not my dad, but as Mr. Rogers would say, won't you be my neighbor? I loved them. We all celebrated Christmas together on their side of the duplex. Joel came out in Christmas pattern pants, and Gina was just a beautiful Latina woman who was in small movie parts and Budweiser calendars. Joel was an actor, too. We all opened presents, and I was just having the most normal Christmas day and soaking up every second of this traditional moment in our lives. Joel gave me a teddy bear. I named it Bailey Bear after Joel's last name. And I just couldn't have loved it more. They were a great couple. When they got married, we got to go to their wedding. And when they even had the rare fight, I could hear it on our side of the thin duplex walls. It was comforting to me to hear a man's voice. They made me feel so safe. They were good people, and they were straightforward in a town that was full of cryptic lives. These were happy years, the most stable years I'd ever had. We lived in this house for 7 years, all the time I could remember. But when I turned 7, after E.T. had premiered and I was starting to get a lot of other film offers, my mother and my life were changing. I will never forget one night when we were all waiting to go to dinner together at the duplex, my mom pulled up in a brand new BMW 320i. I couldn't understand. Where was the beat-up Karmann Ghia? What was happening? Change felt scary. We all went to eat, and I felt like I was on a bad trip. I didn't like it. And weeks later, I came home, and I looked up in horror as I walked up to the duplex. Someone had cut down the bougainvillea bush. I started to cry. This was the entire cover for our house. It was beauty. It was nature. It was the thing that made me say, we don't really have money, but you don't need money to marvel at something. This giant waterfall of burgundy was just gone. I ran back to the avocado tree, terrified. It was still there, but it was completely shaven. That was the day I learned the word pruned. My heart sank. It was just a trunk and branches. I was told it would grow back, and this is just what they had to do in order for it to be healthy. I was sick. We had lived there for 7 years, and no one had pruned or manicured anything, and everything was fine. Was there a new gardener? The car? I ran around in circles. I felt like everything was crashing down around me. And then it dawned on me. The birds of paradise. What state were they in? I made my way slowly over to the side of the house where Joel now parked his old Mustang. Were those freaky birds of paradise unscathed, or had they gotten the royal treatment too? I made my way around the corner, one foot in front of the other, waiting for the reveal. And then I saw them. Green stalks with no heads. They had not escaped whoever came here and took it all away. They were no longer intimidating. They had been guillotined, and there they stood, awaiting rebirth. And for the first time, I felt heartbreak. They didn't deserve it. Sure, they were different. Sure, I had never really understood them. But right now, I just wanted to hold them and tell them it would be okay. And then I realized I didn't know if it would. I didn't understand any of this. Later, my mom came home. She had quit her job and told me that she was going to manage my career full time. And then she dropped the big bomb. We're moving to the valley. I bought a house and we're going to have a real home. As if it was some selling point. I was disgusted. Great. I will be the breadwinner. We will leave Joel and Gina and McBarker and go move to what felt like a planet away. As if I had been lobotomized, we packed our things and moved into our new home, indeed in Sherman Oaks in 1983. It's why I still talk like a Valley girl. That cadence snuck into my life at that sponge-like age of 8 and never left. I will be talking to a high-powered CEO and I will hear myself in my own head and think, fucking Sherman Oaks. The only good news was that the house had a pool, but I missed Poinsettia Place. I never heard from the team of Goodfellow and Faircloth, but I wished them well. Years later, when I was taking care of my dad when he had cancer, I wondered if Daniel was reconnecting with his father somewhere out in the world. I wondered if Joni still dyed her hair. I wondered how Joel and Gina were. I heard they had kids and possibly moved to the valley as well. I think about that avocado tree. As an adult, I was determined to get back to headquarters, and I moved back to West Hollywood. I was in charge of my destiny now, and I bought a house right in the old neighborhood. I wanted to be in the familiar. Things have cleaned up a bit, and the city has spruced up the joint. I take my kids to the same park I went to as a kid, and today I took my daughter Olive for a lollipop in the old convenience mart I would go to with Daniel to buy goodies with the change we made from selling our apples. Currently, I work with a landscape architect named Marcello. Marcello and I have long discussions about plantings and, most important, prunings. He knows that we cannot cut as much as a leaf without deep discussion and reasoning. He sees me start to flip, but I am incredibly respectful. He is the expert, so he takes me through why he has to cut the leaves off the vines every year. He tells me that they literally get a fungus that will kill them unless we trim them annually. He helps me understand that it's death or trimming, and these are my options. He is delicate with me, and I try humor with him. I jokingly tell him that I will cut off his limbs and chase him around with them. He laughs. Yet there is still a small part of him that thinks I am a little crazy. Maybe there is 1% of him that doesn't think I am joking. Maybe that's good. We also have those days where he can see that look in my eye, and we go and buy bougainvillea by the truckload and do large plantings. I plant as much bougainvillea as possible around my house, and I find new areas to put more and more all the time. He and I are cultivators together. When my grandfather, John Barrymore, would hang out with W.C. Fields, W.C. was apparently obsessed with his rose garden. Behind his desk, he had a large chalkboard and wrote on it one day in large letters, "Bloom, you bastards, bloom!" A man after my own heart. I love flowers. I protect flowers. If I see a commercial for a spray that kills dandelions, I'm like, Why? And it pains me. I am on the first line of defense of flowers. And I wonder to this day if those birds of paradise ever grew their heads back. The ghosts of them bloom fresh in my memory all the time. They, like all of us in this neighborhood, were wild. Let us all be like them and defy tradition and yet create our own traditions at the same time. Let us all be wildflowers. Flying high. We had heard about a skydiving place not far from where we lived. Cameron Diaz and I were in a crazy mode where all we wanted to do was adventurous stuff. High off the rush of Charlie's Angels and training in Kung Fu for 4 months straight, and then performing stunts for the next six, we had become total adrenaline junkies. We had just come back from a trip to the Tahitian Islands, where we scuba dived with sharks. It was amazing. 6 foot plus grays and nurses swimming all around in a giant fishbowl of what would normally seem terrifying, but was actually a peaceful descent into silence and awe 60 feet underwater. I liked that you had to use signals and stop talking for a while, and yet everyone could fully communicate. At one point, when our guide took out a huge plastic bag of something that looked like mangled guts, my eyes bugged out. But then he took out a 12-inch blade and sliced it open. The blood went everywhere, and so came the sharks. I quickly motioned to him with a hand-sweeping gesture back and forth across my neck as if to say, "Enough! We're good! Please don't chum the water anymore!" It was crazy to be in a place where in the blink of an eye, things could have gone very bad. And yet, we survived and loved every minute of it. So when we found out that there was a skydiving school about an hour away from Los Angeles, we immediately signed ourselves up and drove out to Paris, California, a total desert landscape. When we arrived at the school, we were met by a bunch of dudes. Hot doggers and bird chasers. I knew from first glance they were all up on my girlfriend's tip. And as long as no one was inappropriate, I just rolled with it. I am forever protective and chivalrous of my friend. She calls me her little man, because in the first Charlie's, we dressed in disguise as men to break into Red Star tech facilities. I looked oddly like a very short James Spader, and she looked like a normal height pencil-pushing CPA. And although I come up to her elbow, the name Little Man stuck. Poo-poo, our mutual nickname for each other, and I have known each other since I was 14 and she was 16. We met in West Hollywood back in the late 80s. There were two beautiful girls, both models, Cameron and Corey. Everyone ogled them, but most importantly, they were both extremely nice and the opposite of cold, but they were cool. We hung around in similar circles for many years. I like any girl's girl, and Cameron was definitely that. But it was when I called her because I was producing Charlie's Angels and dared her to come play that we became so close. She was shooting Being John Malkovich, and I arranged a phone call for us so that I could pitch her the movie because the script hadn't even been written. I talked about tone and what I wanted it to be, but I really stressed the sisterhood and the capability of these women to her. I said, "Girls want to do what boys do without losing the idea that they want love at the end of the day. They also love each other as women, and they are stronger together. They want to kick ass and have fun." I knew that she would get the spirit of women who supported each other and liked to laugh. That's who she has always been. And I knew we would have a blast. And we did. Well, after the films ended, we continued our journey as friends and thrill seekers. So here we were, two girls who wanted to jump out of a plane, and we were watching our instructional videos, which were terrifying. But worse, they make you sign your life away. Literally. You have to sign an "if I don't make it" contract. They tell you it's standard protocol. They also tell you that it's likely you will get cotton mouth on the plane ride up and to bring some water. What the hell was I doing? Just as I started to question if we had gone too far this time, they gave us our suits to change into. I noticed that hers was bright red and mine was canary yellow. We took our balled up material and went into the changing rooms. The guys were kind of making jokes and yucking it up as we changed. I was starting to get the sense that these yahoos were holding themselves back from falling all over themselves for her. It was obvious that they were all salivating, and who wouldn't? I was used to this, and as protective as I was, I got it completely. I loved her too! But in this cacophony of douchebaggery, I was more worried about the question, are these the guys we want to possibly die with? I zipped up my suit, and we both emerged from our curtain makeshift dressing rooms at the same time. My eyes bulged. They had put me in a bright yellow rayon jumpsuit with a giant toucan across the entire front of it. I looked like an Oompa Loompa. Being on autopilot and contemplating my mortality while getting dressed, I was so distracted that I hadn't noticed some jackass had chosen a full-on fucking clown suit for me. Not only did I feel worried, but I also looked like a total idiot. Then my eyes looked over, and they had given Cameron a skin-tight, painted-on, red spandex onesie that literally let you make out every inch of her body. I wanted to punch these assholes. And there we were, Susie Chapstick and Toucan Sam. They told us how good we looked, and I rolled my eyes and uttered fuck you under my breath. They told us it was time to go, and the Fruit Loops outfit went right out of my mind as the sound of the propellers kicking up outside of the building took my full attention now. We walked to the plane. We all had our packs and chutes on now, including an altimeter on my chest. I looked like a human dashboard, and we entered the open plane. It took off. And now I looked down at my altimeter, and it said 1,000 feet. I looked out the window. It seemed really high. I turned to the instructor designated to me and yelled over the whirling air in the plane, "How many feet up do we go before we jump?" He looked at me with a shit-eating grin and said, 10,000 feet! Oh my God. Okay. It looked good enough to me at 2,000 feet, which we were now at as we had gone up another 1,000 since I had last checked my chest meter 1 minute earlier. Wow. My tongue started to expand. I couldn't breathe, but most noteworthy was the infamous cotton mouth they spoke of. My tongue was a combination of sandpaper and felt. Water would not even begin to help the arid nature of my mouth, as it would be like spitting on a forest fire. At around 8,000 feet, I just sat with my mouth open. It was a hollow sand trap and no longer resembled my mouth. My instructor turned to me and asked another in a series of stupid trivial questions. So, what was ET like? Ugh, I simply couldn't answer. Words were not an option at this point, as my tongue had become a fat cashmere taquito. And before I knew it, everyone was starting to stand up and prepare for jumping out. I finally looked at Poo Poo. Having just scuba dived with her, I felt like we could communicate with our eyes. After a deep breath and a stare down, I think we both telepathically said, "These guys are tools. But we came all this way, and it would be a shame to turn back now. They can get us where we need to go, and we need to go out of this plane and rock this goddamn dive. Yes?" I felt better. Cowabunga, let's do this. Just then, one of the guys said, "Who wants to go first?" Feeling my newfound bravado, I raised my hand. Again, I couldn't speak, so I figured my arm would tell everyone I was ready to go. We braced ourselves at the opening of the plane. We were to rock back and forth, tethered to our guides, just like we practiced down at the base training facility. We crouched down, my arms wrapped around my chest like a mummy. They counted out loud.
One!
My tongue was in a new level of useless.
Two!
Oh my God, I'm really doing this.
Three!
Okay, fuck it. Let's dance. And with that, I threw myself out of the plane. Down, down, down we went. And it went on forever. The air was so forceful I couldn't breathe. I wondered how long this would go on because if I didn't die from the jump, I would definitely die from wind inhalation or lack of oxygen. In my periphery, I saw Poo-Poo going straight down headfirst, which actually makes you go faster, so even though she jumped out second, she was now passing me like a human bullet. I continued to hold my breath and prayed to get to the deployed chute part. Open, 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 please God, open! And with that, after a 1 minute long free fall, my chute jerked me up into the air and canopied all around me. As it cascaded out and I started to glide through the air, this was the vision I had. This was the silence I craved. And I gently floated through the air like a soaring bird. I was overwhelmed by the peace I felt. I had made it. I was flying. And just like that, the guy I was tethered to started up on the dumb questions again. So, you gonna make another movie soon? Oh, Christ, shut up. I politely asked how long the gliding down would take, and he said, oh, about 10 minutes. Great, I said. But what I meant was, great, I have to listen to your shit for 10 more minutes when all I want to do is enjoy the landscape. Unlike him, I knew I would not be doing this again anytime soon. After what felt like an eternity, I landed smoothly, I'm happy to say. My instructor took my face and gave me a big grandmother kiss. Yuck! Thanks a lot. First you put me in this clown suit and now you try to grope me? Get me out of here! We got out of there as fast as possible, happy to have our lives and bodies intact. And we drove to the closest place we could find to get something to drink. There was a fast food joint on the side of the road, and we ran inside. 2 sodas and 2 burritos later, we recounted our experience in words, A, because we could talk now without being listened to, and B, because my mouth was functioning again. Just as we got going, and we were quietly screaming about what each of us were going through, Poo-Poo bit into glass in her burrito. Well, if it's not one thing, it's another. You survive jumping out of a plane, but you almost die eating after. We just started laughing, the hardest laugh you can imagine. We took off and drove back to Hollywood with the wind in our faces from the open windows of the car. Although I think it's safe to say that I will never experience wind in my face like that of a free fall at 10,000 feet. Now we are older, and she is still one of my closest friends. I was her bridesmaid, and she is my daughter Frankie's godmother. We still go on adventures all the time, but they are much more mellow. But that's the thing I love about my friend. She is always game, and I will always be her little man. Joshua Tree. My dad. I don't really know where to begin other than to say he simply wasn't a dad. He was this mythical creature, part unicorn, part violent storm. And although he separated from my mom when she was pregnant, I somehow knew to forgive him. It's as if I could grasp as a kid that this horse was so wild he couldn't be pinned down, and even if he could, I'm not sure you would want him around. This was the kind of man you saw in small doses. They were memorable, sometimes dark, sometimes humorous, sometimes quotable. Example, when I was with him as a teenager, he told me he needed food, and I asked him, oh yeah, are you hungry? He looked at me with wide and indignant eyes. Hungry? I was hungry since the day I was born. It made sense, I guess. Another time, he was staying with me for a brief alternate universe visit, and I needed security at my house for a short period. He came walking up my driveway and said, "Daughter, why do you need security? You've got me. I've got my nightstick and my third eye." Right. No one would ever have guessed my father would have ended up being the man he was at that time. He was my grandfather John Barrymore's only son, and he had been a promising actor when he was young. He had been gorgeous and dynamic, but he threw his career away in total self-sabotage. Today, he looked like a frail, homeless old hippie. More someone you would be trying to keep out than allow in. The truth is, I never lived with my father. I never even had a dinner with both my parents. I never knew the whole story of how my parents met and got together. They most likely met at the Comedy Store or the Troubadour. They had a tumultuous few years together and then separated before I was born. My mother and father were both incapable of being parents, and I don't fault them for it. My therapist would disagree, but the truth is they gave me a great blueprint through their behavior of what not to do with my own kids. For starters, I will have so many thousands of dinners with my kids. They will sleep together and go to school and have a bedtime and a life that will be so stable and consistent that they will complain until they grow up and realize that this is the better way. A stable, loving family is something that should absolutely, fundamentally never, ever be taken for granted. I am lucky that I got dealt some of the cards that showed me what it's like not to have a family, and I am much luckier to now have the chance to create my own deck. I will fight like William Braveheart, what's his name, to keep them protected and intact. I am a warrior. I am a soldier. I am a not-to-be-messed-with lion. I am a mother. When I think about my dad, I think most about when he got cancer and I actually got to go and take care of him for a while. I was in my late 20s at the time. He got kicked out of the first hospice house I had put him in for disorderly conduct, weed and erratic behavior, which don't usually go together, but what can I say? I wasn't even surprised in the slightest. But I needed to find him somewhere to live because he needed medical attention 24/7 at this stage in his multiple myeloma. So hanging out at my house was not an option. I finally found a place that would take him, and it actually had an ocean view. And we got him a long, thin pillow to block the scent of his weed from drafting underneath the door. And these people were saints at handling his unreasonable demands. No one could wear perfume around him. Murderers, man! If someone had used detergent, "Oh man, you're killing me!" He would order everyone to wash in nothing but Dr. Bronner soap from head to toe. "You can even brush your teeth with it," he said. And then he would douse himself in real lemon juice and olive oil. He was like a human salad. There were lemons everywhere. I'm talking hundreds. But those were his bottom lines. My father acted like Cleopatra on the throne of his temporary bed. Everything in his life was temporary. For as long as I knew him, or barely knew him, he was always coming from somewhere and going somewhere else. My father never had an apartment. No address to send a letter. No phone to call him if the mood struck. He didn't even wear shoes. Even this crazy man's feet had to be free. He would roam Topanga Canyon in the 70s and 80s and just show up at my mom's duplex with David Carradine of Kung Fu and talk some crazy nonsense, usually wreak havoc on the joint, and then take off again. He and my mom would yell a battle of words and duel about who was wittier or who had made the last genius comeback. They fought like pathetic poets. But really, my mom had just made a terrible choice in my dad, and he wanted to be worshipped from afar without the dare of an expectation. I would just sit there on the other side of the room and count the minutes until he would disappear again. Then he would show up again at a random Christmas dinner at a friend's house where my mom had taken me so that we might be somewhere more traditional and full of life as opposed to the Charlie Brown Christmas tree and single momness of our home. We would be having dinner, and then I would hear the sounds of chaos and commotion coming from the other room. He would then storm in and start ranting, and eventually would have to be escorted out by the hosts. He would do the same thing at a random Chinese restaurant. I don't even know how he found us. He would come crashing in like the Kool-Aid guy, and then a bunch of people would rally and literally take him outside. Yep, I was never really showing off to anyone pointing, "That's my dad!" I was more just watching in awe. Many years later, I hadn't seen him for about 7 or 8 years, and I stood next to him. And he was finally around 50-something, and the drugs and the road had taken his swagger away some, and he just didn't seem like a threat in the slightest. So I went from damaged kid to I could kick his ass status, and the playing field just leveled, and we could become friends. At one time, I told him I was mad at my mom, and he said, "Oh, baby, you gotta kick the bag," as if to say I should let go of any resentment. Okay. He was literally this guy who didn't want to carry anything, literally or metaphorically. And once again, I left thinking, I'll see you when I see you. No pain, no attachments, no drama. I would occasionally get some kind of carrier pigeon type communication from him, as this was all way before cell phones, and we would meet up in Joshua Tree. I would stay in some weird place he had for the weekend, bring my dogs, and we would go in some golf cart, again, where in the world did he get this golf cart, and tool around in Joshua Tree National Monument. Just the two of us and Flossie and Templeton, my cool customer, go anywhere dogs. And I would just love these times. They were easy, strange, temporary, and usually gave me plenty of one-liners to laugh all the way home about. He would talk about the flickering Buddha, quote Walt Whitman, but I really loved when he would share an anecdote about our family, the Barrymores. He made it seem so real. All the Barrymores had passed away before I was born, so there was no dynasty-like upbringing. But I could see why people thought I might have grown up that way. My grandfather was the great actor John Barrymore. They called him and my great-aunt Ethel and my great-uncle Lionel the royal family. I never knew any of them, and I wanted to more than words can ever describe. I would think about my grandfather all the time. Lots of my friends knew their grandparents so well, and I wished I could have had that same luxury. I was particularly fascinated with my grandfather, John. When my dad would talk about his own father, I would listen as if I was being led into this fairy tale world where dangers lurk, but fantastical, magical things can occur. He would talk about the legend of when my grandfather's body was stolen from the morgue by his friends, including W.C. Fields, Errol Flynn, a crazy poet named Sadakichi Hartman, a painter named John Decker, and a writer named Gene Fowler, who wrote the famous book about my grandfather called Goodnight, Sweet Prince. So the legend goes, they stole his body, and in an attempt to give him one last party, they propped up John at a poker table with sunglasses on and a cocktail in hand and invited people over and had one last hell of a soiree. Well, you gotta have handed it to them for not letting death be spoiled by such depressing sadness. They took a whole other approach. It's not one I recommend per se, but this was the line of great loonies from which I come. They were talented, damaged, and I can't help but idealize them because it's all I have. And just like my grandfather's friends, I don't want to be sad about loss. As my father was winding down and his days were numbered, I spent even more time at the hospice house. During the days, I would walk around to stretch my legs and watch the other patients. There was an old couple I would stare at every day I was there. A woman, who was clearly the patient, would sit in a lazy boy chair in the first floor communal room where visitors could congregate. Her husband would sit with her, and sometimes he would just take her face with both hands and bring her face into his, and they would just stay face to face for long periods of time. He would give her these old gummy kisses all over her face, and she would accept his affection, just sitting there with no strength to move. I don't know if he was making up for not doing it enough, or if this was just their routine, but all their years together had led to more love, more affection, more appreciation, a oneness that you would marvel at as I did. My father was upstairs with his weed and his lemons, but he was alone. Maybe he wanted it that way. He certainly alienated everyone along the way, but I would want to be the couple who kissed for hours. I went back upstairs. Later that afternoon, I was sitting in a chair with a little dress on and no shoes, and my father was in bed, just quiet, which was very novel. He was thinking. I don't know when he had time to reflect, as he was always just spouting out demands. Maybe he thought his thoughts in Joshua Tree. Maybe in the middle of the night. Maybe all those years in Topanga Canyon. But now, in this moment, he was gentle. I didn't know where his gaze was, and I wasn't totally sure of what to do in the silence. But I sat there, patiently waiting to hear the next wild thing fly out of his mouth. "You were made perfect," he said, looking at my feet. He looked up into my face and deep into my eyes. "You were made perfect." For the first time in my life, I didn't know what to say. So I just took in the moment and I told myself, "Remember this forever." For it was his way of taking my face and telling me he loved me. He died a few months later. And when I picked up his stuff, there was only Dr. Bronner's soap bottles and lemon rinds and his old floppy threadbare bandanas. So I kept a purple one and threw the hippie detritus away. And we planned a ceremony where we would let his ashes fly all over his home away from no home, Joshua Tree. I drove out there late at night and got a room in the middle of the desert, and the hotel had forgot to leave a key, so I slept in my car. When the sun just started coming up and it wasn't so terrifyingly dark, I looked for a key and I found one taped in a strange place with a note for me. But I would have needed my third eye and a flashlight to find it, as my dad would have said. I walked through the dirt to my little room and lay down for a while. And just as I was falling asleep, my door slowly swung open on its own. And a ray of sun came pouring in. "Dad," I said out loud as I felt a field of energy pass through the room. I sat up in bed for a while, silent, until it felt like I could get up and respectfully shut the door. I got back in bed. Was it him? Could have been. Why not? There are no rules. My beautiful laundrette. When I was 14, I was emancipated by the courts. It's no secret that I had to part ways from my mother because we had driven our relationship into the ground. She had lost credibility as a mother by taking me to Studio 54, so wrong but so fun, instead of school. And I was out of control due to working since I was 11 months old and what that had done to my childhood, which made me grow up too fast. Work was a very positive thing in my life, and sadly it had been taken away because my mother also put me in an institution because she felt helpless. But when people found out, they just wrote me off as damaged goods, and I sadly understood that. I was never unprofessional, but I was on a hiatus from being employable. And when I turned 14 and wanted to start my life over, I wanted to do things on my own terms. On the day of my hearing, my mother was there in full support of my emancipation, which would mean me living on my own. I felt so sad, but too much had happened. The judge walked in and the day went on in a blur. People testified, but it wasn't heavy or dark. It was a way to ask, should this kid become an adult? At the end of the day, the judge looked at me and said these words, which stuck with me. I can turn the clock forward, but I can never turn it back. Are you ready for that? Yes, I said. Okay, he said with a slight smile. I hereby pronounce you an adult, legally. My mom and I hugged, knowing that things would be different, but they always were just too different. And that was why this needed to happen. I walked out an 18-year-old in the eyes of the state of California. This was gonna be fun. First, on my checklist, I needed... 1, apartment. I looked all over West Hollywood, my favorite neighborhood and where I had grown up. I found a place in the back of a building my friend Justine was living at. Great. Although it was off an alleyway in a notoriously don't walk around here at night neighborhood, I was happy that my girlfriend was a stone's throw away. She lived there with her boyfriend, and I particularly loved when they fought. I was always secretly willing them to break up because I would fantasize about Justine and me getting our own bungalow somewhere. Whenever she and Darren had a blowout, she would come hang out in my place and then Darren would perform some big mea culpa outside. He would grab the bars on the window. Did I mention the apartment had to have bars covering every window? But to Darren, they were like a stage prop. Stanley Kowalski, the 90s former model version, would hang on these bars and scream how he needed her! And it was her fault too! Blah, blah, blah. She always let him back in. Whatever. Boys were a whole other chapter that I knew I wasn't up for yet. What's next? Oh, right. 2, job. Justine worked at a coffee house in the valley, but she had a car and I was 2 years away from getting my driver's license, so I was going to have to act global and think local. Inspired by Justine, I looked at coffee houses near us. The Living Room, which happened to be one of the big LA hotspots at night. It was the start of the 1990s and coffee houses were where everyone hung out. People poured out onto the street every night as if it was a big art opening, but it would just be a random Tuesday. I wasn't great at my job. I wasn't really great at anything. I had only done 2 things, acted and had wildlife experiences. But neither of those prepares you for the real world. At all. My apartment, when I came back to it, was a mess. It smelled like wood from the IKEA pieces I had bought that still lay in the boxes. How in the world were these ever going to get erected? And my fridge was literally a science project. I had only takeout cartons and to-go boxes that had lost their shapes, but much worse, they had all grown spores. Yes, it's true. I didn't even know that you were supposed to throw them away. Somehow my nutty 14-year-old brain would put the half-eaten food back in the fridge rather than in the garbage. Even if I knew somewhere in my juvenile brain that I probably wasn't ever going to return to that General Tso's chicken, I would just place it next to a half-eaten sandwich. It was as if they should just live together. Like an edible toy story where the fridge comes to life when I shut the door. But somehow, looking every night at the growing pile of laundry was the thing that really sent me over the edge. I stared at that massive pile of clothes. It soon became like a bubbling blob-like horror movie that would just start to have the Jaws theme every time I looked at it. The chords of the piano were slow. Donna, 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 Donna. And then at the height of the music, where you know that goddamn shark is coming, I would quickly look away and shut my eyes, and the music would end. The hum of my old fridge and the moaning sounds of the alley cats would soothe me. Sleep. But sleep was scary, too. Somewhere in West Hollywood, I was very alone. I needed something to comfort me, something to fall in love with, something romantic, something transportive, something safe. I opened a classic novel I had acquired and read myself to sleep. Somewhere around when the sun came up, I felt safe enough to close my eyes, my book right next to me like a stuffed animal or the lover I wasn't old enough to have. I went to work the next day, and I could tell my boss, who had hired me on the novel idea of having a washed-up former child actor behind the counter, was patient with all of my learning curves, but was also irritated with me. "You must be here for the muffin deliveries at 7 a.m. sharp, or else I won't have anything to put in the damn cases." "Okay, got it." It was a little in one ear and out the other. Another time, he came in when I was doing dishes, which, come to think of it, probably subconsciously made me realize you actually had to do dishes rather than just put everything in the sink and pray like I did at home. But he walked in and said very sharply and exasperatedly, "Don't use the abrasive side of the brush! All the pastry cases are getting scratched and foggy, and you can't see what's inside!" "Oh, you're right. I thought it was getting cleaner, but yeah, I see what you mean, huh? I was wondering why that was happening." He looked at me with wide eyes and clearly went into the other room and muttered, "Idiot," under his breath. But again, he liked me, and I had truly ruined some stuff. He had every right to be miffed. I went back to my apartment after work, feeling like a bit of a loser. I looked around the dirty apartment. Everything I touched turned to shit. The fridge, the sink, the furniture that lay lifeless on the floor in 50 pieces, and the laundry. I didn't even know what I was wearing because everything I owned was in that basket taunting me. I hurled myself on the bed and clutched my pillow, staring at the wall all night as the sun crept up into the creepy alley outside my bedroom window. I knew that I had survived another night. But this wasn't what I pictured when I left that courthouse with a skip in my step. Something had to give. I loved a self-improvement movie montage, and I actually had to create one. Cue the music! Okay, what did I need first? Basics. Toilet paper. Sponge. Soap. Vacuum. Intimidating. A man to put my furniture together. Bedside table, lamp, more books for that table. Yeah, books were great. Books made me happy and helped me feel not so alone. I chipped away at things one by one. But where the montage really started to soar was when I walked into a store to buy a laundry basket. There were all sorts of shapes and sizes, a whole wall of baskets. After holding different ones, as I knew I would be hoofing it several blocks to a laundromat, I needed it to fit my body. I picked one, and I walked out with my brand new vessel. I bought detergent, bleach, and fabric softener. I grabbed my book and enough clothes to fill the basket sensibly and headed out the door. In my maiden voyage to the laundromat, the whole way I was talking to myself. Bleach first, detergent, wait, first cycle has bleach and detergent? That doesn't sound right. And the liquid fabric softener goes in the dryer? But isn't that going to make the clothes wet all over again? I was very confused. Well, it doesn't seem like all three go in the wash. What? No. I had given myself a stomach ache. I walked in and I went to the machines. Which ones were which? Was this the washer or the dryer? What the hell? The circle shapes all around started to close in on me. I was Michael Keaton in Mr. Mom before he figures it all out. I was screwed. I just stood there. After a while, like a kid cheating on a test, I just started to spy on whatever other people were doing. Okay, that guy is pulling out wet clothes, so that must be the washer. Aha! Got it! Right. It was also the kind of place where some of the washers were upright, so the washer and the dryer looked the same, stacked on top of each other, which confused me so much because I was convinced all the water would come pouring out and I would make the biggest fool out of myself ever.